So we're learning these sugyas in eighth parak of Yoma regarding pikuach nefesh. I wanted to just start with a couple of thoughts on why these are particularly relevant right now. I think you can probably guess already, but you know, this, to the extent that there is one classic area that talks about pikuach nefesh and its application in a variety of areas, it's these dapim from Pei Beis to Pei Hei in Yoma that talk about it. We're going to see as we move through, it's not organized in conceptual order. The most fundamental sugya is actually probably at the end in terms of what the basis is for pikuach nefesh, but God willing, we'll get there. But all of these sugyas are important things. Today we're going to talk about, Ubra Sheiricha, the case of pregnant women on Yom Kippur in certain scenarios. So I'd say two reasons why these sugyas are particularly important to be learning. One, we're on Zoom now, we're not in person. Coronavirus, we've all heard the drill a million times, but what sort of emerges from the way we've been living for the last five or so months is that essentially the most important mitzvah that we've all been doing is the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. We've all been, by distancing, by doing all the other activities that are recommended, that have been recommended by poskim, by not going, shutting down shuls and not going to minyanim, as jarring as that may be, as many have pointed out, that's a fulfillment of pikuach nefesh, which is a very important, really essential, fundamental mitzvah. And my thought was learning about that in some more detail over this summer could be a good thing to understand not just what to do, but also a bit more about the idea of pikuach nefesh, what stands behind it. That being said, this is not a halacha shir, this is a gemara shir, so we're going to focus more on the principles, but things, there are a bunch of Rambams, a bunch of Shulchan Aruchs that we're going to be looking at, and we'll be able to see the full application of many of these dinim as we learn through them, but again, with an emphasis on the gemara, on these sugyas, and how they play out. The other reason why this is relevant, I think this is part of a trend over the past few years, but maybe even most extensively this year, in terms of ubros umenikos, pregnant and nursing women, and questions of fasting. I think we heard very recently in terms of fasting on Tisha B'Av and fasting on Yom Kippur is also relevant, that there's a lot of discussion over circumstances in which it's permitted to break the fast or it's required to break the fast. So it's not just an issue that comes up now. It's an issue that goes back to our Gemara, our sources that we're going to see today. And it's good, again, to get the principles, not just your Facebook guidelines of when to break the fast, when not, but to see some of the underlying issues. So I think both the broader limud that we're doing and including today's limud we start with of Ubra, Sheiricha, these are issues of great practical importance. And it's certainly worth looking back and considering the Gemaras that they're based on, the early sources that they're based on, to get a better appreciation and understanding of these halachos. With that said, we're going to move now. We're going to read the Mishnah and Gemara. So do we have a volunteer for reading, for starting the reading?
Sure.
Okay, Rivka, yeah, why don't you start with the Mishnah?
Sorry, do you actually want me to translate or just reading?
If you're up for translating, that would be great.
Okay. So we have either the fetus or the pregnant woman that smelled something. So you feed her until her mind has settled. Chole machirin oto al pi bekiim, ve'im en sham bekiim machirin oto al pi atzmo ad sheyomar dai. A sick person, you feed according to what the experts say, and if there are no experts there, then you can feed them according to what they say until they say to stop.
Okay, great. Great reading. And so we have two different scenarios here, right? We have the first scenario, as Rivka said, of the ubra, which either means the mother of the fetus or the fetus, and they smell something, and Rivka, what they smell something, and therefore what comes along with that?
And therefore, had some desire to eat it, you might call it a craving if it's a pregnant woman.
Right, they have some craving for a particular food that they've smelled, and the assumption is that if they don't eat if they don't eat that food, they'll be in physical danger potentially. And similarly, the case of the chole, right, someone who's sick, where the presumption is that they need to eat or else they're in danger, and they in each case we allow them to eat. Are the standards exactly the same here, Rivka?
They're not. In the first case, you just need her to say that, like, she wants it, or even, like, to just have that craving. Whereas with the chole, you actually need experts, and only in the case when there are no experts there who can tell you, like, yes, this person is in sakana, if they're in danger if they don't eat. Only in that case can their own word be trusted.
Right. So there seems to be, and again, this gets complicated in the Gemaras, but it sounds like there's a distinction, right? As Rivka said, the case of the Ubra, as long as it's Ubra Sheiricha, she has that desire for the food that she smells, she immediately can eat. Whereas for a chola, for a sick person, you need experts. You need to bring in the doctors, ideally at least, to allow him to eat. If there are no doctors, if there's no experts, then, you know, then you have no choice. But that sounds like there's a distinction there. Okay, great. Now the Gemara. Do we have a new volunteer for starting off the Gemara? Not everyone at once.
I can volunteer.
Okay, Dvora, go for it.
Okay, so the Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, Uba Sharicha Basar Kodesh, O Basar Chazir, Tochvin La Kush Berote, Menachin La Alpia. So if you have, right, either, so we have a Breita, either the fetus or the pregnant woman, depending, that smells meat that's either hektish, so sanctified in, for the Mikdash, and you're not allowed to eat it, or something, you know, that's not kosher, like pig's meat. We insert a reed into the sauce of the meat, and then we put it on her lips. In nitya shavada ta mutav, so if she settles down, then that's good. V'im la ma'achilam ta'rotav atzma. If she doesn't settle down, then we feed her the actual sauce itself. V'im nitya shavada ta mutav, if she settles down after getting the actual sauce, then very good. V'im la ma'achilam ta'shum an atzmo. And if she doesn't settle down, then we actually feed her the actual fat of the meat. She'en l'cha davar she'omi bifnei pikuach nefesh chutz me'avod hazara gilaras v'shvichut damim. Because you don't have anything that, you know, kind of stands up in the face of pikuach nefesh except for the three things that you have to be killed for, which is, or die, I guess, which is idolatry, adultery or gilai rios, and killing other people.
Okay, great. So, right, so this, we get some detail in the Gemara here on the scenario of Ubra Shehiricha, although it's a slightly different scenario, right? It's not talking about Yom Kippur. It's talking about non-kosher food or super kosher food, right? Food that can't be eaten by the woman in question. And, right, so, but it's essentially the same conclusion, right? The same conclusion that if she smells something and needs to eat it for her health, and here it's a specific food, right? That's prohibited. We allow her to eat it. And how would you? What's the relationship between the process of what she eats exactly as in the Braisa here, as compared to the Mishnah, Dvorah?
Yeah. So my chavrus and I were discussing this because all of it's usher. I mean, presumably, like there's at least like usher ta'am, like usher taste in the sauce also. But it sounds like we like try to first give her like as detached from the actual food itself as possible. Like first she kind of like sucks it up a thin reed. Maybe she's only getting like the really liquidy parts. Not entirely sure what the difference is between step one and step two. And then we like actually give her the sauce itself. And then we give her, you know, the like more, I don't know, mamashus, how do you say that? Like substantial food.
Right, so there's three levels in the Braisa, right? And not the Mishnah doesn't spell these out, but it seems like the Gemara thinks that this is an explication of the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah says, you feed her ad shetashiv nafsha, until she restores her life force, or something like that, right? What does that mean? Presumably, the Gemara thinks it means these steps, meaning you don't give her everything all at once. You give her the minimum necessary to make her feeling better. Right, and the Gemara then spells out these three steps. And as Dvorah points out, it's not exactly obvious what the difference is. But I think we can set it up like this: that just tasting is maybe not even eating. Right, if you just taste something, you're not even eating it. certainly you have less than a shear, but maybe it's not even considered an act of eating at all. If you're just, you know, just tasting it, and you sort of stick, you know, put a little stick in the gravy and put it to your lips, maybe that doesn't even count as eating. Once you eat the rotev, the mixture, so it's rotev, right? It's not all, let's say, pig. It's not all pig. It's whatever, 10% pig and 90% whatever you're cooking it in, right? So that's a taroves. That's usur to eat, obviously, but it's only usur v'taroves, which is certainly at a much lower level than eating the pig or the fat. I guess it has it. The case shifts a bit, right? It talks or shuman, right? The fat of the pig, which would be clearly biblically prohibited on a higher level than the rest. We're going to get into these details in a later shir. This is one formulation we're going to get to in a later gemara more explicitly. One formulation of hakal, meaning when someone is sick and they need to eat for their health, ma'achilin also hakal. We feed them as leniently as possible, meaning we have them violate as few prohibitions as possible, and we slowly ramp up the level of prohibition we're violating as necessary. So ideally, just the taste, that's the best. You know, just eating a mixture of non-kosher food is, you know, slightly less ideal, but if necessary, we do it. And then feeding mamish treif, right, the literal pork fat, bacon, that we're willing to do if it's necessary. So we'll see that in a lot of other cases. We'll talk about that in more detail. Okay, so that's the Mishnah, the Gemara's explication of the Mishnah, and some questions we're going to have is worth thinking about is, when does this apply, right? Because we have it in a brisa talking about a pregnant woman with non-kosher food, but it doesn't explicitly say it about Yom Kippur, and it doesn't say it about a chole. So, you know, it just raises some questions as to what exactly this applies to. Did someone want to ask a question or raise a point?
Rivka? Yeah? Quick question. We weren't sure exactly what the phrase Tochvin Lakush Barotev means, like whether it's sounded like Devorah thought it was like a straw sort of thing, or whether it was just like putting it near her mouth. Like, what exactly is it?
Yeah, so right, so it's not exactly clear, right? You put it on her mouth. What does that mean? Is she actually ingesting it or not? It sounds like it's just sort of putting it on the lips to get a taste of it, which is not really eating. There's, you know, in different halakhic contexts, there's a discussion about as to whether tasting is, you know, really counts as eating if you're not fully ingesting. So I think that's part of the goal here, that she's not even consuming it. And again, the idea is to get the flavor. I think I spoke about this with someone in their Seder. It could be that the issue here is that, you know, there's different ways of thinking about it. You could think of it that any woman anyone who's in a situation of heiricha is assumed to be sick, and we're trying to solve her sickness. Or it could be that at least some of these stages are like attempts to figure out if she really is sick, meaning maybe if just putting it to her lips is enough, she obviously wasn't that sick, right? She just had a craving for that smell or that taste, but she doesn't actually need to consume food or that forbidden food in order to get better, right? So it could be, you could see the stages of ramping up as not necessarily she is sick and this is how we treat her, but we're trying to figure out how sick she is or how much she needs to eat the food, right? You can think of it in a couple different ways. Okay, and now, Adira, please.
Yeah, I feel like it is talking about Yom Kippur, because if it wouldn't be talking about Yom Kippur, why would we like do it hakel? Why wouldn't we just give her something else completely?
So we'll get to this when we get to some of the other sources. But one could argue that the idea of hakal hakal would apply by any case of pikuach nefesh involving non-kosher food, right? You shouldn't eat pork, and if you need to eat pork, eat the least porkful things possible, right? Or eat other things if you're starving and you only have non-kosher foods, right? You're on a desert island. You only have a few different types of non-kosher foods, so eat the least treif foods possible. Right, and then the question is, so that this brice is pretty clear that it applies in the case of the Basar Kodesh and the Chazir. The question is whether you apply that to Yom Kippur or not. There's a little bit of discussion on that. So hold those thoughts for when we get to the sources that explicitly discuss them. Any other thoughts, ideas, questions? Okay, so we now skip the sugya of the big three, which the Gemara spells out because, as Dvorah read, they're invoked. They're the exceptions. We'll talk about that at in a later shir, I'd say either tomorrow or Wednesday. But for now, we have essentially the continuation of our sugya, the more relevant part of our sugya, and I think we need another volunteer to read from Pei Beis Amid Beis, about halfway down Hahi Ubra.
Okay, Hahi Ubra de Archa, also a Kame Derebi, Omer Lahu Zilu Lachu Shula de Yomatiki Purahu. So we have like an Ubar that smells something and craves it. So they come before, the woman comes before Rebbe, and he tells her, like, go whisper to the fetus that it's Yom Kippur. Lachu Shula v'ichlisha. So she like whispers it to the fetus, and the fetus is like satisfied, no longer desires it.
Yes, just one small grammatical thing. The Asu Lekame de Rebbe, the people who went before Rebbe is them, like the people. I assume that means not the pregnant woman herself, but some people in her household, and then they went and whispered into her ear. That's what it sounds like from the Gemara, right? So, and that's Rashi spells out Lechoshula Beozna, right? You people who came to Rebbe, he advised them go and whisper it in her ear. Okay, and what do they whisper to her?
Yom Kippur.
It's Yom Kippur, right? Obviously, what are you doing? You want to eat food. It's Yom Kippur, right? See if you can hold out until after Yom Kippur.
So, Karyalaha b'tara matzircha b'baten yadaticha v'gomer nafak minay Rabbi Yochanan. So they like quoted this pasuk about this like incident that like Hashem saying to Yirmiyahu in the context like you knew me like. Before I knew you, before I created you, what I created you in the womb before you were born, and this Uber turned out to be Rabbi Yochanan.
Right. So since it worked, right? How often when you tell a baby, I don't know if you talk to I don't know how you can talk to fetuses. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. There's a whole literature on this whether the fetus hears you. But fine, assuming you can talk to fetuses that they can understand Yom Kippur and realize that they should like hold off the craving that they're creating until after Yom Kippur. That's pretty frum, right? So it's pretty frum, and that's why, as Nettie said, the pasuk about Yirmiyahu, that Yirmiyahu was chosen by Hashem before he was even born, so that they applied that to Rabbi Yochanan. This baby, this fetus, is going to be some great Torah sage because they're very frum and they know how to keep Yom Kippur even in the womb, right? And that became that fetus became Rabbi Yochanan, the great sage. So it worked out well. Okay, but now we contrast that to the next story.
So ahi uvra de archa asu lakame de rabbi chanina, sorry, amr lahu lachushala below ilchisha, karalaha zoru rishai mirechem, nafak mina shabsai atzer piri. So in this other incident, again, like the uvar smells something and they come before Rabbi Chanina, and he tells them the same thing to like whisper that it's Yom Kippur, but this time the like child is not, the uvar is not satisfied, and they quote this pasuk of like, Rishayim are like strangers even from the womb. And the fetus turns out to be Shabtai, who was like a hoarder of food and would like hoard food and then like inflate the prices, I think Rashi says, during times of famine.
Great, right. You hoard the fruits, you raise the prices artificially, you make people starve. And it doesn't spell this out, but I wonder if, it's very fitting, right? This is someone who was hoarding. He couldn't wait until Yom Kippur was over to have the craving be fulfilled, this baby, this fetus. And for that reason, that was a sign that he was going to become the type of person who hoarded produce in other times and made other people starve, right? In a famine, other people end up starving because you're hoarding food. Here, you're not letting your mother fast on Yom Kippur because you're, again, hoarding food in the same way. Presumably there's some sort of poetic justice there. We're not going to get into the theological, philosophical issues of whether this is actually saying that people are decided as good or evil in the womb. That would be an interesting discussion, but that's not really the core of our sugya here. It seems like it's mentioned, but it's not necessarily, it's not really a principle as put here, and there are other sources that seem to indicate that people have free will, certainly. So we're not going to get into that, first, Yeshkoach to the three readers. All you all did great jobs. Let's move now from, we read the Gemaras. We have some of the basic sources. We raised a couple of the questions in context. Let's try to sort out some of the issues here. What these standards apply to exactly and what the basis for this might be. So the first question, the most basic question, and I think Rivka mentioned this, but we're going to look through some sources that spell this out explicitly. What does Ubra Shehiricha mean? It's the our Mishnah. It's the our case. It's our whole discussion. But what are we talking about? What is an ubra? So I think I guess people want, they can shout out answers, or we can go through the sources and yeah, and see, do it that way. If there's no volunteers, we can let's jump in. Let's jump into the source number 3, which is the Rambam. Rambam Perish Mishnayos, commenting on the Mishnah, right? That's a pretty straightforward place to go. If you want to know what a word in the Mishnah means, you want to know what our case is. So the Rambam says, V'chein im heiricha, isha ubra, b'sar kodesh o b'sar chazir, v'nis ora nafsha lechol machinot sam yuven, v'nach t'siyashiv nafsha. Rambam is very clear. We're talking about an isha ubra, a pregnant woman, that smells something. That makes a lot of sense because we're discussing this in the feminine, right? Ubra sheheiricha. Right, so it's in the feminine, presumably because it's the mother who's a woman, right? If it was a default pronoun in Hebrew, that's usually masculine. So that's presumably the Rambam's clue. Ubra means isha ubra, the mother who's pregnant. She smells something and she wants to eat it. We feed it to her. Ajdis yashiv nafsha. One interesting thing in the Rambam, says that this case is talking about b'sar kodesh or b'sar chazir, not that it's talking about Yom Kippur. Whereas it seems, given the context, we're in Maseches Yoma, the previous Mishnah talks about whether kids fast on Yom Kippur. It sounds like we're talking about Yom Kippur. The Gemara's later on talk about Yom Kippur. But the Rambam, I guess, based on the Braisa that we started with, which jumps to talking about eating non-kosher, assumes we're talking about non-kosher in the Mishnah as well. Sort of an interesting point. That's Rambam. On the other hand, Rashi and Rav Avadya Bar Tanura, quoting Rashi, maybe has a slightly different angle here, which is as follows, right? Source number 4, Rav Avadya Bar Tanura, or really it's, I think, just about word for word from Rashi, which is, Ubar Sheheiricha, Ha'ubar Meiriach Reach HaTavshil. Who's doing the smelling? The Ubar, the baby, right? And the problem with that reading is, why are you saying Ubra, right? You just said it's an Ubar. It's a, you know, it's a default, default gendered fetus. I mean, we don't know if it's a baby boy or baby girl. It doesn't really matter. You would say Ubar. Why are we saying Ubra in the Mishnah? That seems unusual. So, but fine. That's the weakness in his reading. He says the baby, the Ubar, the fetus smells the Reach Tavshil v'himis avelo, and then he shifts into feminine. He, right? She, maybe the mother. Maybe he's shifting from the baby to the mother. The mother therefore wishes to eat the food because the baby wants it. Vim eno cheles shneim misukanim. This is an important line, ready back in Rashi. If you don't eat, what happens? Right, shneim misukanim. They're both in danger. If the mother doesn't eat, both the mother and the fetus are in danger, even though the fetus is the one who smelled the meat. Now, what's implicit in this approach of Rashi followed by Rav Avadya Bar Tanura? What do they seem to be implying?
That just the fetus is not enough.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, right? Why not just say, if the mother doesn't eat, the fetus is in danger. The fetus is the one who smelled it and the one who's interested in it. Why not say that? Maybe that's because we wouldn't save a fetus's life on Yom Kippur. Meaning, if the only thing that's in danger is the fetus being, being terminated, but not the mother, the mother's health is fine, then we wouldn't eat. That's why we need to say both the mother and the fetus are in danger. That very well may be how to read Rashi and the Rav here, although there may be other understandings as well. Fine. So we have with the Rambam and with Rashi, we have two different understandings of what the word Ubra means. Either it means the mother or it means the baby, but either way, the mother's life is in danger. Right? In both of their readings, the mother's life is in danger.
Can I ask a question on the Rambam?
Sure.
We were just curious, in Kavruta, we opened the Rambam also, we didn't find the word Isha in any of the versions that we opened, so we were just curious like where this came from.
The word Isha in...
in any of the versions of the Rambam that we opened.
Interesting, in the book versions.
They're all online, but like on Safari and a couple of other sites.
Interesting, so this is from Bar Ilan. I could check what their version is. So, I mean, first, the most important thing to know about...
that much, it was just...
The most important thing, no, it's an important question. The most important thing to know about the Rambam's Perish Mishnayos is that it was written in Arabic and translated from Arabic into Hebrew. So it's, and there are different translations of different quality and different, done some more recently, some historic, some like even within the Rambam's lifetime. So the question is, what was the Arabic? and how does it translate, right? Because you could easily, Arabic like Hebrew has a gendered language in this sort of way. So it might have been that the Arabic was translated in two different ways, some with the word isha and some not. But just give me 1 second, I can check or try to check who the Bar Ilan's edition's translation is based on. So give me a moment, and let's see. Okay. It's a very long biography for the Rambam, for obvious reasons. So, in the back of the Gemaras, they don't like the translation so much, but this one, here, they have it as, based on Rav Kafich's translation. I think that's what they included, and I think that's seen as the most accurate of the Rambam's Shir Shoshanayim. So I assume there's reason to trust the Bar Ilan translation here. So Isha Ubra, it's talking about a woman, it's talking about the mother. Fine, so what do we have so far? We have the Rambam saying that Ubra means the mother, and the mother's in danger. Rashi and Rav Bar Shneur saying Ubra means the baby, but still the mother's also in danger. And let's continue. Tosfos Yom Tov is going to try to explain things. Why do they say what they say? Ubra Sheiricha, he quotes Kasav Arav, and he says, Chen Kasav Rashi, that the Ubar, Shediktigu Lefarish Kain. So why do they think it's the baby, right? Why not just say it's the mother? Ubra, it's feminine. Why would you not just say it's the mother? Nearly Shediktigu Lefarish Kain, Mehani Uvda, to Isnu Begmara. The Gemara, that's the source of this reading, right? Why would you think it's the baby that's hungry and not the mother that's hungry? Well, that's what the Gemara seems to think. But the Gemara seems to think that the baby is the one that you quiet down with the taste, or you whisper, it's Yom Kippur, and then the baby comes down and they say, oh, this is a really firm baby. Well, if you say Ubra means the mother, it has nothing to do with the baby, right? So it must be that Ubra means the baby, even though the mother's also in danger. Okay, so that's interesting. The Hon Ashir, different commentary in the Mishnah, has a slightly different angle. Ubra Sheiricha Muberes Lo Katani Ela Ubra. It's a weird word, right? We know how to say a pregnant woman in Hebrew, Muberes. That's how the Mishnah always says it. Why are we saying Ubra here? Very odd. Denera Dimash Meuso Hua Ubar Shela. Well, that's because Ubra, it's not Ubra like Ubra, like a feminine baby. It's Ubra with a mapik hey, her baby, right? The mother's fetus, her baby. Shehu garam la sheheiricha v'hesava. So Ubra sheheiricha, right? It's her baby that made her implicitly, and made her have these cravings. Shehu garam la sheheiricha v'hesava. So that's what it's all about. It's about grammar, which is about the word Ubra must mean her fetus, and that's what the Rav means. The Tos Yom Tov we just saw, he didn't know grammar so well, or he wasn't thinking about this issue, and that's why he gave a whole explanation based on the Gemara. But really, it's not based on the Gemara. It's based on simple grammar. It's based on simple grammar. Fine. Now, so that's what we have in terms of what Ubra means, right? It either means the mother, or right, a mother, a pregnant mother, or a fetus in the feminine, or Ubra, her fetus. That maybe grammatically is the best option. So that's what we have so far. And the next couple sources on the handout give us a little bit of background, right? Starting from the Meiri, but the idea that we don't explicitly say here that the normal case of an Ubra who's not Heiricha, a normal pregnant woman, is expected to fast on Yom Kippur. Right, that's not mentioned in our Gemara. That is mentioned, though, in Psachim Daf Nun Dalid, as the Meiri points out, his bar with Psachim Nun Dalid Beis Ubros Umenikos Misanos Yom Kippurim. Right, pregnant and nursing mothers generally fast on Yom Kippur. If you look in the sugya there in Psachim, it's actually talking about Tisha B'Av and various prohibitions on Tisha B'Av, not doing malach on Tisha B'Av, fasting on Tisha B'Av, and there's a line. Shmuel says that the only Tainus Tzibur in Bavel, the only public fast in Bavel, is on Tisha B'Av, and the line we quote a Brisa: "Ein ben Tisha B'Av liyom Kippurim elash zes feiko asur zes feiko mutter." The only difference between Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur is the suffik, which presumably means Bein Hashmashos, as to whether you continue the fast during that time. And then we say, or maybe it's about Kivud Yarcha, but then Darash Rava, Ubro Suminikos, Misano Sumashlimos Bo. Pregnant and nursing women not only fast, but complete the fast. They do a full fast on both Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. Kederek Shemis Anos, Umashlimos Yom Kippurim. Tisha B'Av, just like Yom Kippur, Ubein Hashmashos Shelo Aser, but Safek, including a Safek of Bein Hashmashos, we don't prohibit. But this is the source, this is the classic source for both Yom Kippur and extended to Tisha B'Av being times when pregnant and nursing women fast. Now, are they exactly the same? Is the standard for fasting exactly the same? It sounds from this Gemara like it is, but it's not so simple. A lot of poskim distinguish in various ways, and that's come up in some of the recent talk that we're not going to get into. But just good to have that as a principle. And sources 9 and 10 show the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch poskiming that. Ubros uminikos misanos umashlimos betish above, etc. They poskin those Gemaras. Right, the Shulchan Aruch says the full line. Ubros uminikos misanos betish above, kiderach shemis anos umashlimos b'yom kippur. You do a full, right, a pregnant nursing woman, there's a full fast on Tisha B'Av, just like on Yom Kippur. So even though in the normal case, pregnant women fast on Yom Kippur, halachically, there are cases, the case of Ubra She'iricha, where they wouldn't. Now, there's really two large issues to think about in context. One is, what difference is there, if any, between saving the mother and saving the fetus? And that obviously came up in the grammatical question, right? If someone would have a reading that says, we're talking about the mother, but not the baby, or that even though the word ubra means the baby, we're not talking about saving the baby, we're talking about saving the mother too, maybe that's because we wouldn't save just a fetus on Yom Kippur. It wouldn't be worth breaking Yom Kippur to save a fetus's life. So that's one question. The other question is, what's the relationship or the difference between an uberes generally, a pregnant woman in general, the specific case of a pregnant woman and the case of a chole, a sick person, more generally? Are there any differences? So with our remaining time, we're going to try to deal with issue number one, the difference between the mother and the fetus in terms of whether both would lead to violating Yom Kippur to save their life, or doing what usually is a violation of Yom Kippur. So the Ramban in Toras HaAdam, he has a composition about different stages of life and end of life, one of which is Shar HaMechush, Inyan HaSakana, dealing with danger and Pikuach Nefesh. So it's a long essay dealing with a lot of issues. This piece talks about our sugya. So he quotes Balachos Gedolos, he quotes the Bahag, the late Gaon source, who says, Isha Ubra, Diad Inan Di'ilo Achla Misakir Vlada, a woman who's pregnant, who we know, if she doesn't eat, she will lose her fetus. Avagav Davrinan Safik Ben Kayamahu, Safik Nefel, even if we're not sure if the baby's going to survive or not. Right? Back then, they had high infant mortality rates. Halachically, we consider unborn babies, even baby up to a month old, as a suffix, whether they're going to be able to actually live long-term, whether they're really viable. Shapir dami lemitan la. We still allow her to eat on Yom Kippur, even though her fetus is only a suffix, whether it will survive. Rav Yitzchak bar Geath, right, the Ritz Geis Amar, he says, lav biyadia didan talya milsa, el biyadia dida uvedaita talya milsa. It's not really what we think, it's all up to her. Right, as some of us read in the Mishnah, I think Rivka said in the Mishnah, right, it doesn't really matter if we think she needs to eat or not. It's all dependent on how she's feeling. She automatically qualifies as sick once she smells. We'll hold that thought. We'll get to that probably tomorrow. Umistabra kibal halachos. It makes sense, like the Bahag, that we actually follow, we evaluate the danger and follow that. Shim amra, sricha ani, pshitin machilin osa, ela filu ro osa misave, la osa reach, meaning, the Ramban wants to read the Bahag is actually more lenient. If either she asks to eat the thing that she's smelling, or she doesn't ask to eat it, but we can tell that she's, her face is pale, we can tell that she has a craving for a certain food, we allow her to eat in that case as well. Why? The choshin le'ikur, we're worried about her losing the pregnancy, and that's a reason to violate Yom Kippur. And he's going to spell this out. Even if the mother is not in danger at all, says the Ramban, you still violate Yom Kippur to save the baby. This is against what it looked like we saw from the Mishnah, both the Rambam and Rashi. Right? Both the Rambam and Rashi seem to say that the mother's life was in danger, not a case of just the baby's life. The Ramban says explicitly, if just the baby's life is in danger, the fetus's life, we violate Shabbos. We violate Yom Kippur anyway. And he quotes on this basis a Gemara in Erechin. We're not going to read it inside, but essentially, a woman is in the process of giving birth on Shabbos, and she dies in childbirth. So what do? We say Mevi'in Sakin Umekarin Es Kresa. Essentially, she's already dead. We cut her open in order to save the fetus. And then the question is, what's the violation of cutting open someone who's already dead? But we say that we're even allowed to carry the knife. The Gemara says, you're even allowed to carry the knife in Rishus Rabim. You're allowed to violate Shabbos, Midah Raisa, in order to save the baby. Kamash Malan, we see from here, says the Ramban, that we save a life even in a case of Safek. And not only a case of Safek where there's no Chazaka Dechiyusa. Right, the fetus not only may or may not be viable, but its default, right, it was previously, prior to being a fetus, it was not alive, right? It was nothing prior to being a fetus. So it does not have a default presumption of living, of a chazakah, and still, in a case of safek, we violate Shabbos by carrying to save the life of the fetus. The Ramban says the same thing here, we violate Yom Kippur to save the life of the fetus, even though it's only a safek. And, fine. Then the Ramban gets into a different issue. We're not going to get into this. It's really a fascinating sugya about rodef, the case of rodef of a fetus, right? If the fetus is in the process of being born and doctors say either the mother's going to die or the fetus is going to die. So what the halachically, you're supposed to terminate the fetus until the point at which it's born. Once it's born, then you can't terminate the fetus. You let the mother die. That implies that the fetus, prior to being born, is not a full life, does not have the full status of life, because otherwise, why would you terminate the fetus before, you know, if it's not yet born, right? So that implies it's not alive. So the Ramban has to deal with this issue. So on the one hand, we have a Gemara in Erechin that implies that we do pikuach nefesh, we violate Shabbos, midoraisa, to save the fetus. On the other hand, we have the Gemara, or really the Mishnah in Alos, implying that we abort the fetus in order to save the mother's life. Presumably it's not yet alive. It's not yet considered a person. How does the Ramban resolve this? And he has a fascinating chiddush that's a really deep principle. And we'll read the Ramban inside now from about six lines up. The Ramban also raises another issue that if someone accidentally hits a pregnant woman and kills the baby, You don't get charged with murder. You get charged with a financial penalty. So it sounds like that means that the baby is not a person, right? Because you don't get charged with murder. So how does he explain this? Afilu hachi le'inyan shmiras mitzvos mechalin alea. In terms of mitzvos, like eating not kosher, keeping Shabbos, we violate all these mitzvos in order to save the life of the fetus. Why? Amra Torah chalal alav Shabbos achas. Shema Yishmor Shabbosos Harbe. A line we're going to see in the Gemara in a couple of lat from now. It doesn't sound like we don't usually passing like this, but the Ramban seems to think we do. Chal Shabbos Achas, that you're allowed to violate one Shabbos to save a person's life so that they'll be able to keep many Shabbosos. The Ramban says this applies even to people who are not yet alive. Even though a fetus is not considered alive, sounds like the Ramban is saying that here, the fetus is considered a future life. And in this fetus's future life, it will have the possibility of keeping Shabbos. For that reason, not the usual reason of pikuach nefesh, of this person is alive, and therefore we violate the Torah to save them. That's not why we violate Shabbos. We violate Shabbos, and all mitzvos by extension, because chal Shabbos achas. Violate one Shabbos, it's like, do the math, right? You're violating one Shabbos now, but this baby's going to keep a lot of Shabbos later. It's a consequentialist consideration, if you will. We're just thinking about results. We want to maximize Shabbos is kept. And that's why we save this baby, this fetus, even though it's actually not alive. It's not considered alive, and yet it's a future life, and it's a future Shabbos observant life, and therefore we violate Shabbos by carrying, or by extension, we violate Yom Kippur by having the mother eat on Yom Kippur in order to save the baby's life. Amar Torah Chala Shabbos Achas, Shabbos is Harbe, Hilkach Afilu Be'atzalas Ubar, Pachos Mi Ben Arbaim Yom. There's another nafkamina to this. A fetus less than 40 days old, it's not even, like, no one thinks that that's a life. Right, there's a whole discussion, whole machlokes in halacha and also in other contexts, which we're not going to get into, but in halacha as to whether fetuses are considered alive or not. The Ramban seems to think they're not, but It's very rare. Just about no one thinks that a fetus within the first 40 days is alive. It's too early in the process to count as alive. The Rabban says it doesn't matter. If it's within the first 40 days, you still are Mechal Shabbos or Yom Kippur to save the life. Why? Because it doesn't matter that it's not alive. That's not the point. The point is it's a potential future life that's going to keep Shabbos. Chal of Shabbos Achas Kish Yishmor Shabbosos Harbe. That's the Ramban's understanding of the Bahag and the way the Ramban himself holds. A big Kiddush, a new idea of how Pikuach Nefesh works. It's not based on saving a life. I mean, that's also true. That's a separate rule. It's even true that you do Pikuach Nefesh to save a potential life because of Chal of Shabbos Achas.
That's a question.
We'll just finish the rest of the Ramban, and then we'll have questions because we're already over time. The Ika the Sphere Lay. She'em Mechal Mishim Nefalim. Some people think you don't violate Yom Kippur to save a fetus. El Uber Sheiricha Chashad Misa Didahu. We're worried about the mother dying. As we said, sounds like Rashi and Rambam say. Shekol Ma'pelas Bechezka Sakana. Right? Why? Anytime, as Rashi said, anytime someone miscarries or has an abortion, that's a danger to the life of the mother. Again, nowadays that may or may not be true medically, but back then that was the case. V'taima Diosheves Al Machber Shemesa Taima Achrinahu the Kivin Shemesa Reu Kiyalu. Why do we save the baby then on Shabbos by carrying? Right? Didn't we have a Gemara in Erechin say you can carry on Shabbos to save the baby if the mother dies? Well, the answer is, once the mother's dead, the fetus is considered to have been born. So in that case, the fetus actually is alive, and we do save their life in that case. It's now considered born, it's just trapped inside its mother, and that's why we violate Shabbos to take it out, because it's considered born. That's the other view. The Ramban does not seem to agree with this view, but this is the other view, that we don't save fetuses on Shabbos. My understanding is halachically we do. We hold like the Ramban's own position. But this is one of the core issues that comes up in our Mishnah, Uber Sheiricha. What does Uber mean? Is Uber the mother or the baby? If it's the baby, are we worried about the baby's life or the mother's life? The Ramban says, even if we're only worried about the fetus's life, that is reason enough to violate Yom Kippur. Why? Are you because you're saving a life? No, you're not saving a life. You're saving a potential future life, which will then keep Shabbos. Chalo of Shabbos Achas Geshishmar Shabbos Harbe, a big Kiddush of the Ramban. And as he says, some argue, but I believe we paskin like the Ramban. I think we are now